Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome back to the radio program and podcast that helps you learn American English. Today we go back into the classroom for an official English lesson. Do you know what modals are? We will explain and show you how they affect American English. This is an important lesson, so listen carefully. Then you can use what you learned in part two of our program. It is about our nearest star, the Sun, and solar storms that are being studied by American scientists. So let's get started with part one. Jonathan Evans begins our lesson.
For VOA, Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. This week, we will give you some tips on how to use modals to make requests and give permission. Some common modals for expressing permission are may, can, and could. But these modals have multiple meanings that can be confusing for English learners. Children in American schools learn to use the modal may when asking for permission. A student might ask the teacher, "May I be excused?" before leaving the room. When students asked, "Can I leave the room?" their teachers often made a joke, "You can, but you may not." The teacher was saying the student is able to leave the room, but does not have permission to do so. May is the most formal way to ask for permission. The distinction between can and may is slowly disappearing in English.
These days, it is not always clear if may is being used to express permission or possibility, or both. Let's look at some examples in the language of internet privacy policies. When you visit a website for the first time, you often see a pop-up box asking for permission to collect information about you. Privacy laws in some countries require websites to tell you what information is collected and how it will be used. A common privacy statement includes this sentence: "We may collect various types of information when you visit any of our sites." Let's see what this legal language really means. "We may collect information" means that you give the company permission to collect information about you. In other words, you allow the company to save your email address or your computer's address. But may has multiple meanings. In addition to expressing permission, may also expresses possibility. For example, "It may rain" means that there is a possibility of rain.
Let's go back to our privacy example. "We may collect various types of information when you visit any of our sites." The policy contains some clever legal language. "We may collect information" means we have permission to collect information. But it could also mean there is a possibility that we will collect information. One could make an argument for both meanings. As an internet user, you should assume both meanings of may are part of the policy. A third modal for making polite request is could. For example, "Could I please have some water?" Could is the past tense of can. However, when asking for permission, could does not have a past tense meaning. Could has the same meaning as may when making requests. It is equally polite to say, "Could I leave early?" or "May I leave early?" Could is used with any subject to ask for permission. For example, could I open the window or could you open the window are both grammatical.
Be careful with may. When making a request using may, only I can be the subject. If you are making a formal request to dance with someone, you would say, may I have this dance? Not, may you have this dance. May followed by you does not express a request. It expresses a wish, as in, may you live long.
But that's another episode. Until next time, we'll leave you with a song of permission by The Temptations. I'm Jonathan Evans with Ashley Thompson.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Sunspots are a product of huge electromagnetic storms on the sun. Scientists on Earth are able to observe sunspots 8 minutes after they happen. That is how long it takes for the sun's light to reach us. The first electrically charged particles from a sunspot enter Earth's atmosphere about 20 to 30 minutes after the storm happens. These particles can harm human beings. So before they arrive, astronauts on the International Space Station move into special areas designed to protect them from their effects. About a day or two later, the biggest part of the storm arrives. It is called a coronal mass ejection.
That's billions of tons of solar material that's blown away from the sun. But it's traveling millions of kilometers an hour, but that's relatively slow.
That is Alex Young. He is the Associate Director for Science at NASA's Heliophysics Science Division. Several civilian government agencies and the U.S. Air Force watch weather conditions in space 24 hours a day. NASA does so because it must protect its astronauts and the electronic devices on its spacecraft. Scientists are also trying to understand why the number of sunspots rises and falls at almost regular intervals every 11 years. In other words, scientists can almost predict the amount of solar activity.
Also, sometimes the intensity is higher and sometimes lower. For example, the current solar cycle, as we call it, that we're in, is much lower than the previous one.
Several satellites watch the sun and the environment between the sun and the Earth. Pictures and other information from the satellites tell scientists what is happening on and near the sun. Alex Young says we have only been looking at the sun with powerful instruments for about 30 to 40 years. That is a very short time compared to the 4 billion years that the star has been shining. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America. We come to you every day from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. The United States Botanic Garden has launched a field project with a really big goal. Vicky Funk, a botanist with the Smithsonian Institution, explains.
We're trying to get about half of the diversity of plant life on Earth at the genus level in 2 years.
The effort is part of what Smithsonian officials are calling the Global Genome Initiative. Its goal is to classify 50% of all plant species. Vicky Funk admits it seems like a huge project, but says the Botanic Garden is a great place to start.
Because if you look around you, you see all kinds of plants from all over the world growing right next to one another. And so instead of having to go to Madagascar to get a plant and Hawaii to get a plant, you can get them in rooms that are adjacent to one another.
Many of the species are already growing in botanic gardens, places known for their collections of rare or endangered plants. The aim is to set up a program to classify plants at 36 partner organizations in 17 countries. One recent day in Washington, Vicky Funk performed a test run on a long-stemmed pink flower called Sabbatia. She took pictures of the plant. She then put one piece into silica gel and dropped another piece into liquid nitrogen, where it is frozen. Next, she removed the flower and pressed it in a plant book for a museum collection.
The plants are placed between these corrugates that have holes in them, and when we get the press back, we put it into a dryer that blows hot air through it, and overnight it'll turn it into a beautiful specimen. Usually it saves the color, it looks very nice.
All the plants are numbered and linked in a computer database with the frozen pieces. These specimens are sent to the Smithsonian Institute's Genomics Laboratory for studies of their genetic material. Jonathan Coddington directs the Genome Initiative at the Smithsonian's Museum of Natural History. He says the project is on target to gather samples from all 10,000 plant and animal families and have the genera in those families within 5 years.
Just into our biorepository, in the pipeline, I have over 2,000 families and close to 12,000 genera.
Jonathan Coddington says that biorepository is the largest such facility in the world. It collects, classifies, and stores samples.
What we want to do is organize it and get a lot of information evenly spaced out across all of life, from bacteria to humans.
College student Kristen Van Ness is helping with the project.
What we're doing is important because it's not just for our use, it's for future use.
Scientists will use the information to identify species, study climate change, and look for new cures for diseases. I'm Marcia James.
From VOA Learning English, this is The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we tell about slavery and how it affected the history of the United States.
Slavery is the custom of one person controlling or owning another. Some historians say it began following the development of farming about 10,000 years ago. People forced prisoners of war to work for them. Other slaves were criminals or people who could not repay money they owed. It is said the first known slaves lived more than 5,000 years ago in the Sumerian society of what is now Iraq. Slavery also existed among people in China, India, Africa, the Middle East, and the Americas. It expanded as trade and industry increased. This increase created a demand for a labor force to produce goods for export. Slaves did most of the work. Most ancient people thought of slavery as a natural condition that could happen to anyone at any time. Few saw it as evil or unfair. In most cities, slaves could be freed by their owners and become citizens. In later times, slaves provided the labor needed to produce products that were in demand. Sugar was one of these products. Italians established large sugar farms beginning around the 12th century. They used slaves from Russia and other parts of Europe to do the work. By the year 1300, African blacks had begun to replace the Russian slaves. They were bought or captured from North African Arabs, who used them as slaves for years. By the 1500s, Spain and Portugal had American colonies. The Europeans forced native Indians to work in large farms and mines in the colonies. Most of the Indians died from European diseases and poor treatment. So the Spanish and Portuguese began to bring in people from West Africa as slaves. France, Britain, and the Netherlands did the same in their American colonies. England's southern colonies in North America developed a farm economy that could not survive without slave labor. Many slaves lived on large farms called plantations. These plantations produced important crops traded by the colony, crops such as cotton and tobacco. Each plantation was like a small village owned by one family. That family lived in a large house, usually facing a river. Many separate buildings were needed on a plantation. For example, a building was needed for cooking, and buildings were needed for workers to produce goods, such as furniture, that were used on the plantation. The business of the plantation was farming, so there also were barns for animals and buildings for storing and drying crops. There was a house to smoke meat so it could be kept safely, and there was a place on the river from which goods were sent by ship to England. The plantation owner controlled the farm and saw that it earned money. He supervised, fed, and clothed the people living on the property, including the slaves. Larger plantations might have 200 slaves. They worked in the fields on crops that would be sold or eaten by the people who lived on the plantation. They also raised animals for meat and milk. Field slaves worked very long and hard. They worked each day from the time the sun rose until it set. Many of these slaves lived in extreme poverty, in small houses with no heat or furniture. Sometimes 5 or 10 people lived together in one room. House slaves usually lived in the home of the plantation owner. They did the cooking and cleaning in the house. House slaves worked fewer hours than field slaves, but were more closely supervised by the owner and his family. Laws approved in the southern colonies made it illegal for slaves to marry, own property, or earn their freedom. These laws also barred slaves from receiving an education or even learning to read. But some owners permitted their slaves to earn their freedom or gave them money for good work. Other owners punished slaves to get them to work. The punishments included beatings, withholding food, and threatening to sell members of a slave's family. Some plantation owners executed slaves suspected of serious crimes by hanging them or burning them alive. Historians say that people who were rich enough to own many slaves became leaders in their local areas. They were members of the local governments. They attended meetings of the legislatures in the capitals of their colonies, usually 2 times a year. Slave owners had the time and the education to greatly influence political life in the southern colonies, because the hard work on their farms was done by slaves. Today, most people in the world condemn slavery. That was not true in the early years of the American nation. Many Americans thought slavery was evil, but necessary. Yet, owning slaves was common among the richer people in the early 1700s. Many of the leaders in the colonies who fought for American independence owned slaves. This was true in the northern colonies as well as the southern ones. One example is the famous American diplomat, inventor, and businessman Benjamin Franklin. He owned slaves for 30 years and sold them at his general store. But his ideas about slavery changed during his long life. Benjamin Franklin started the first schools to teach blacks and later argued for their freedom. Slavery did not become a force in the northern colonies, mainly because of economic reasons. Cold weather and poor soil could not support such a farm economy as was found in the South. As a result, the North came to depend on manufacturing and trade. Trade was the way colonists got the English goods they needed. It was also the way to earn money by selling products found in the New World. New England became a center for such trade across the seas. The people who lived there became shipbuilders so they could send the products to England. They used local wood to build the ships. They also sold wood and wood products. They became businessmen carrying goods around the world. The New England shipbuilding towns near the Atlantic Ocean grew quickly as a result. The largest of these towns was Boston, Massachusetts. By 1720, it had more than 10,000 people. Only two towns in England were larger, London and Bristol. More than 25% of the men in Boston had invested in shipping or worked in it. Ship captains and businessmen held most of the public offices. The American colonies traded goods such as whale oil, ginger, iron, wood, and rum, an alcoholic drink made from sugar cane. Ships carried these goods from the New England colonies to Africa. There they were traded for black Africans who became slaves in the American colonies. The Africans had been captured by enemy tribesmen and sold to African slave traders. The New England ship captains would buy as many as they could put on their ships. Conditions on these ships were cruel. The Africans were crowded together and forced to travel in areas so small they could hardly move. Some were kept in chains. Many killed themselves rather than live under such conditions. Others died of health disorders they caught on the ship. Yet many did survive the trip and became slaves in the southern colonies or in the Caribbean islands. Black slaves were needed to work on Caribbean sugar plantations. The southern American colonies needed them to work on the tobacco and rice plantations. By 1750, almost 25% of the total number of people in the American colonies were black slaves. From the 1500s to the 1800s, Europeans sent about 12 million black slaves from Africa to America. Almost 2 million people died on those slave ships. Historians say English ships carried the greatest number of Africans into slavery. One slave ship captain came to hate what he was doing and turned to religion. His name was John Newton. He stopped taking part in the slave trade and became a leader in the Anglican Church. He is famous for having written the song Amazing Grace.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now
you can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s.